Well, you must have heard the Thai people are in mourning today. Sensitive coverage, I think, by quite a lot of different outlets after the death of their king, His Majesty King Bhumibol, who'd been monarch for more than 70 years. And what comes next is full of question marks. In August, for instance, Thai voters approved a draft constitution that the existing military leadership claims will ensure stability, whereas critics argue it is undemocratic and entrenches the military's power. The Crown Prince Maha Vajiralongkorn will be invited to ascend the throne, effectively securing the formal succession, though I note this morning the reports that a regent has been appointed, so that's yet another uncertainty. What we're interested in today is both some reflection on what citizens of Thailand can expect in this crucial stage of transition for a country so steeped in monarchy, and I noticed today the Australian's Greg Sheridan said there really are quite profound implications of this next stage in their lives. But also, what of Australia's exposure to the country to our near north, so beloved of millions of Australian tourists over the years, but also our seventh largest trading partner? Well, joining me now is Dr. Greg Raymond, Research Fellow in the Strategic and Defence Studies Centre at the Coral Bell School of Asia Pacific Affairs, that's at the ANU in Canberra. He wrote his doctoral thesis on Thailand's strategic culture, and he's currently working on a research project looking at Thailand, the United States and China. And before joining the ANU, he worked in the Department of Defence. Good morning, Greg.
Good morning, Geraldine.
By way of analogy, could you give us something of a context? Would the emotions that the Thai people are going through be anything akin to what might follow the death of Queen Elizabeth?
I think so, but I think on a greater scale, if we can imagine that. Now, Queen Elizabeth is very respected, very revered, and there's a great deal of affection for her. But in the Thai context, the king has a semi-religious status, which I think amplifies the presence of the monarch in the people's minds. So Thailand is still a very devoutly Buddhist country, and religion and views of the supernatural are very much interwoven with everyday life. And the king is part of that landscape, that spiritual and mental landscape, in a way which I don't think is the same in secular countries such as England and other Western countries. So there is an added dimension which I think connects the people to the king in Thailand. And, you know, I've heard military officers say to me that the king is like a centre of gravity and the country can't survive without it. So in a sense, the country is almost identified with the monarchy. So it's a very deep relationship on a number of levels.
Yes, he ascended to, though I was looking at the history last night, he ascended the throne. He wasn't in line, really. He was quite down the line following the mysterious shooting of his elder brother, by which time, I might add, it was already a constitutional monarchy. So we're not talking about an absolute monarchy. That stopped in 1932. But this shooting, which has never been solved, of his elder brother.
Yes, correct. Very mysterious circumstances, really surprising, and it was a pivotal moment, really, in the Thai political context at that time. It had a lot of political ramifications and consequences for a number of the political leaders at the time. One of the foremost of the, 1932 revolutionaries, who you mentioned the 1932 revolution, Priti Banumyong, was implicated in Anan Mahidon. That was the name of the young king who died in that accident. He was implicated and in the end was forced to leave and take refuge overseas as a result of rumours floating around that he'd been responsible. So it was it marked a power shift in Thailand and actually led Thailand towards a series of military dictatorships. So in a sense, a turning point, not just for the royal family, but for Thailand more generally.
And the king actually found his body.
Well, that's right.
That's pretty big, isn't it? And they were, so he obviously devoted himself to this stability, which, you know, various people are wondering about now. I mean, the kingdom has seen 19 coups, 12 successful. That's an extraordinary rate of instability.
It's very significant, and I guess shows that democracy is far from deeply rooted in Thailand, even now. What I think is significant is that it wasn't really until almost over a decade later, after Bhumibol had officially ascended the throne, that he began to actually achieve the status, achieve the profile that he eventually assumed. And this was as a result of a tacit agreement between the monarchical institution and the military, which occurred in about 1957 under the dictator Sarit Thanirat. Up until then, the military and the monarchy had been rivals. In 1957, they became partners, and that's a partnership which has remained in place since that time.
So how do you judge the durability of that partnership now? I mean, maybe there's a regent coming in, but maybe it's this Crown Prince, who, of course, trained at Duntroon, but is a very complicated character, to put it nicely.
I think it's become a very institutionalized relationship. There are a myriad of connections which link the military to the monarchy, and it's something which is instilled in not only in military amongst all Thai people, but extremely strongly in the Thai military, a reverence for kings in Thai history. Now, the Thai military was founded as a royal bodyguard. For a period of time, that relationship, as I said, was weaker from about 1932 to 1957. But since that time, it has been strengthened. And as an example, I think, which is very telling, is that if any member of the military has a family member who passes away, at their cremation, a flame will be brought from the Grand Palace, which is a symbol of the king's linkage with that family. So if you imagine those connections in everyday life, the king's picture is everywhere. When someone is promoted, it's in front of a picture of the king. Those linkages are very strong and have now been really institutionalized. So the prince is a different character, certainly, and whether or not there is the same degree of personal affection can be questioned, but I think the institutional linkages are very, very strong and won't be removed quickly or easily.
Twice now, but it's not easy to find them. I have seen references over the last couple of years, particularly when there was so much turbulence between the red and the yellow shirts, to a sort of what was described as a Praetorian guard that the Crown Prince had assembled. And there were very little details given. It really struck me. I thought, what's all this about? Do you know?
I'm not quite sure what the reference is there. The prince has a relationship with the military. He trained, as you know, in Duntroon, and he's a pilot.
He lives in Germany now, but by and large, doesn't he?
I understand that he does travel there regularly. I think his relationship with the military will largely be a continuation of the military, of the relationships which has existed. I don't think at the moment that he would exercise any powers beyond those that normally reside in the monarchy. Mm. And that is a non-executive role largely, although there is a strong symbolic role which from time to time can emerge, particularly at times of political crisis. And I guess this is where you may look at statements such as that by the Privy Councillor, Brem Gibson Lalonde, who's just taken over as regent. He once compared, and this was in the lead-up to the 2006 coup, the military to a horse. And in relationship to the horse, the government was a jockey, whereas the monarchy was the owner. And that, I guess, was a very nice encapsulation of how that military monarchy partnership sometimes transcends the normal civil military relations which we see in Western countries.
So what is your view on the constitution then? Again, they've had, I think, 20 in 84 years. So this is, again, in a very interesting bit of a statistic about the nature of this society. It could be evolving, or it could be indicative of turbulence. Do you think it strengthens the military's control? I mean, is there any likelihood of Thaksin Shinawat, the former prime minister, or anyone associated with his party being elected again?
I think that's his party. I think the Pheu-Thai may gain seats, may gain a significant number of seats in the next election. I think they have not been ruled out or dissolved at this point, so they will compete. But the arrangements under the constitution may mean, and the voting system may mean, that their strength in the lower house is not as strong as it would have been under the former constitution. It also means that there are a number of mechanisms that can be used to remove a prime minister who is not seen, I guess, by various elites to be appropriate for occupying that position. Thaksin himself, of course, he can't come back. He's facing criminal charges. His sister, the former Prime Minister Yingluck, she is also going through a lengthy judicial process in relation to her role in the rice pledging scheme, which is alleged to have lost Thailand vast amounts of money. So both those are non-contenders for the prime ministership. There may be others who are more closely affiliated who may try and step in, but as I say, their prospects at the next election are less strong than they would have been under the previous constitution, and now there are a number of mechanisms where they could easily be removed.
And you think there will be a next election in the usual time, do you? I mean, the official mourning period gives the military leadership a reason to hold off, doesn't it?
I think it's hard. My thinking is that there's unlikely to be an election during this mourning period. Mm. So that gives, I guess, really only the latter part of 2017 for an election. Whether or not they will have that the arrangements in place, I think it's too early to tell.
Look, how significant is the Thai economy in the wider Southeast Asian region, and how important is it to Australian investors and the Australian economy? Because there's billions of dollars. It's our seventh largest, I think it's eighth now, largest trading partner.
Yeah, it's a $20 billion. I was just looking at the figures last night. It's a $20 billion trade relationship. Look, Thailand's the second largest economy in ASEAN. It's the second largest economy after Indonesia. So it is a significant economy, you know, 68 million people. So, you know, it's not a make or break country for Australia, but a country that we are, you know, increasing our trade relationship. There was a free trade relationship signed, I think, in 2006, 2005, and those provisions are still kicking in, as I understand it. I'm not an expert on Australia's trade with Thailand, but I understand that, you know, increasingly we are exporting much of our farm produce. We will be looking to export more beef and dairy products. We already export quite a significant amount of mineral and energy exports. So I think they're a country which are important to us, and I think, you know, whenever there's, I guess, prospects of a downturn in China, we will be looking for alternative markets. And not that I think that's on the cards at the moment, but I think, you know, the Australia in the Asia white paper that was done on Ken Henry really emphasised all of Asia and the growing middle classes in those countries as places which we should be cultivating as customers for exports, not only for merchandise, but for services, particularly education.
I wonder whether there's any chance that the lese majeste laws, which are so very, very serious there, might be changed by an incoming regent or a new king. We had, listeners may vaguely remember, 3 years ago, we had a very interesting guest from China, from Thailand called Pravit Rajanaprok, who actually worked for The Nation newspaper. He'd been brought out here for a storyology conference that the Media Alliance runs, and he was very good. And he's had two bouts in prison for lese majeste laws. And he actually wrote to me over the night saying that I think there are 70 people facing charges on lese majeste. I mean, it limits all conversation. We couldn't get anybody in Thailand to speak to us. We wanted them to join us. So could you see any change coming there so that we might talk about it more openly?
I don't see any change, any prospect for that law being abolished or modified at this point in time. I don't think there's any significant group within the Thai elites, within the Thai, government, who are envisaging a change. It simply really would completely undermine, the role of the monarchy that it currently holds if free discussion of the monarchy and its performance, its drawbacks, its virtues. If any of that could be discussed in a very open, analytical way, it would completely change the Thai political dynamic. And I think there's certainly not a readiness for that at the moment. And that's, that it was borne out by the way in which, the changes in the political landscape which were occurring under Thaksin Shinawat seemed to erode that very monarchical-based political system, and that was part of the reason. Many commentators believe that he, in the end, was forced from power.
Right. Thank you very much indeed for joining us, Greg, for that overview. Very helpful.
You're very welcome, Geraldine.
And, of course, you can be punished by up to 15 years in prison for breaching those laws. Greg Raymond from the Coral Bell School of Asia-Pacific Affairs at the ANU. Tomorrow on RN, Rear Vision will revisit the life of King Bhumibol. So that's at 12 o'clock on Sunday, and they're always terrific to hear as overviews. It was very good when it first went to air. It'll be even better now.